the Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very, very good morning. How are you doing?
I'm not sure about sensible, Howard, but I did hear Howard Saxton say that he tries to be politically correct. I was just wondering if that was, no, you know, tongue-in-cheek as well or not.
No, he was saying collectively as a society. He never claims to be politically correct.
Anthony, you should only see me when I try to offend.
Absolutely.
But anyway, one of the things that we weren't going to talk about, which is sort of breaking news from this morning, is once again a Syrian claim that Israel has attacked a weapons warehouse in the southern Syrian area, apparently a warehouse that's been used by Iranians. It's kind of deja vu. It's almost like we've heard the story 100 times before. You know, do we really want to talk about it? It hardly even gets reported in the press. But it is important, and I think it's important for two reasons. First of all, it's important because the Israeli security services are really following things, and every little arms shipment that can potentially be neutralized at the point that it's dropped in Syria rather than waiting for it to be fired into Israel is really important. And I think it is just evidence that Israel continues to be proactive in trying to prevent what could be a fairly substantial war with Hezbollah and, of course, with the Iranian forces that that are proxy in that southern Syrian area and, of course, along the Lebanese border. So, you know, it's just another same old story, and yet the relevance is that Israel is just continuing to chip away at every possible possible little building block that the Iranians are constructing in Syria, which could potentially be, you know, really, really dangerous in the event of a future conflict on that border.
And of course, this goes to the point, was it Tzachi Hanegbi who said that we're the only people killing Iranians, which is a very clumsy way of saying something. But the point is that he was trying to make is that that Israel's the only people at war, the only country that's actually doing something active about the Iranian situation.
Correct. Unfortunately, it's a little it's too little, and it's not really focused on where it needs to be. But who knows? Maybe the UK position, with Boris Johnson having assumed now number 10 Downing Street, will change. It'll be interesting to see where all of that goes as well.
Yeah, there is already speculation that he's going to pull out of the nuclear agreement, the 2015 nuclear agreement. So that's going to be interesting to see. Hamas has said that there is an opportunity to negotiate the return of the Israelis being held in Gaza and Israeli soldiers missing in action being held by Hamas. What gave rise to this opportunity at this time?
Well, I don't know if it's opportunistic and it's a way of Hamas just trying to raise expectations only for them to be dashed afterwards. But it kind of comes in the wake of, you know, that highly publicized meeting that took place between Prime Minister Netanyahu about a week ago, along with the families of the Israelis who are currently in Gaza. And I use the word Israelis loosely because there are two individuals who are believed to be alive, two people who are mentally unwell, who of their own volition went into Gaza and who have disappeared. And of course, there are the two bodies of the soldiers who were killed in Operation Protective Edge, which yesterday had its commemoration, its 5-year commemoration. And so those are kind of the Israelis missing in Gaza at the moment. And, you know, there was a publicized meeting, particularly with the mother of Hadar Goldin, who was in tears and felt that the government is really not doing enough and is giving concessions to Hamas and to people in Gaza without demanding before giving the concessions that they return the bodies and the individuals which are being held in Gaza. Now, of course, with the official state ceremony that was held in Jerusalem yesterday that commemorated the Israeli fallen soldiers in the 2014 Operation Protective Edge, that was clearly an opportunistic moment for Hamas to come up and say, by the way, while you are thinking about, you know, those who were lost in that particular operation, and while you are thinking about the Israelis who are currently in Gaza, there is this window that we're opening up, which could potentially allow for an exchange deal. They don't say what the deal would involve and whether it's even feasible to think about it, because as we know, the price that was paid, for example, when Gilad Shalit was released, and I was one of the people who said, I think we need to pay that price. But it was a very, very heavy price to pay. And we've now discovered a lot of information about the prisoners who were released during the course of that particular exchange deal. Many of them went back to terror. Many of them had to be re-arrested again. Some of them are still serving time in jail again after having been re-arrested. You know, many of them were very, very active on the ground in conducting terror activities against Israelis. Some of them succeeded in killing people. So, you know, this is the price that we might have to pay in order to regain those individuals who are missing in Gaza at the moment. And of course, they invoke the Ron Arad story, trying to give the impression that if we wait and don't take advantage of this particular window of opportunity, that we might be waiting forever, you know, because, you know, the Ron Arad story is a very sad one where we've kind of seemed to have lost the trail of exactly what happened to him. And in fact, there are even some people who want to believe that he's still alive. So, you know, that's a very, very unfortunate story, and we certainly wouldn't want the Gaza situation to go there. I think it's opportunistic. I don't know that it's a real thing that the Gazans, that the Hamas representative is trying to present at the moment. But I have absolutely no doubt in my mind that there are people who have been nominated by the government on behalf of the State of Israel to see, do whatever they can to regain these Israelis missing in Gaza. And I'm sure that they are very familiar with what's going on. Of course, they won't say anything publicly, but I'm guessing that this particular publicity is probably frustrating them at the moment.
All right. And Anthony, U.S. administration officials are visiting the Middle East this week to promote the peace plan. Is there a timetable for this? You know, there was all this, there was the meeting in June. It was, there was a lot of publicity around it, but where do we go from here?
Well, there are a few things that are happening. It was interesting that Jason Greenblatt was at the UN Security Council yesterday to try to explain a little bit more about the US's position on this peace deal that they're trying to promote. And, you know, he said a few interesting things which some Israelis are interpreting in a negative sort of way to Israel, because he didn't completely close the door on the possibility that Jerusalem could form part, could be a capital of a future Palestinian state. Israelis see it in kind of black and white terms, which means either Jerusalem is the capital of Israel or it is potentially the capital of a future Palestinian state, but they don't see any kind of way of it satisfying both of those. And I think that the way that the US administration sees this is that if they slice off a piece of East Jerusalem, one of the kind of very, very eastern suburbs, and they nominate that to be the capital of a future Palestinian state, it doesn't really necessarily encroach upon the Jerusalem that we know today being the capital of Israel. And certainly Jason Greenblatt said that in his speech yesterday, where he, you know, very much supported the fact that Jerusalem, as far as the US administration is concerned, is the capital of Israel. And he went quite far in the way that he said it, because he, I'm quoting what he said, "No international consensus or interpretation of international law will persuade the United States or Israel that a city in which Jews have lived and worshipped for nearly 3,000 years and has been the capital of the Jewish state for 70 years is not today and forever the capital of Israel." Very strong words, in my view, to be uttered at the UN Security Council. So that's his way of really reinforcing the US administration's view that Jerusalem will be the capital of Israel going forward without any issue. However, there is still this notion that a piece of Jerusalem may well be sliced off and may well form part of a future Palestinian state and even become its capital in order to satisfy the notion, the kind of general idea that's being promoted out there, that Jerusalem should be the capital of a future Palestinian state. So I think it's going to be a part of Jerusalem rather than Jerusalem as we know it. But also, the US administration seems to be very intent at the moment on still promoting the economic plan before they get to the political plan. And there were some references to the political plan and the fact that there is no a desire at the moment to get involved in some of those political issues. So the focus is very much on the political plan. And I think that the visit that's going to be taking place by Jared Kushner, and I'm not sure if Jason Greenblatt will join him, but I believe that anyway it's going to be a fairly senior team. They're going to be visiting a number of different countries around the Middle East, and I think that their focus is still going to be very much on the economic side of things, how they're going to get this fund together, who's going to put the money in, how the money is going to ultimately be distributed. So I think all of that economic stuff is currently still very much the focus, and Trump is holding back on the publication of what the political side of the US proposal is going to be. But I think it's going to be interesting, and in all honesty, when there was a lot of cynicism about, you know, this great plan that never seemed to come out, and we waited years and years and years until the plan eventually came out. Now that the economic side has kind of been published, I think a lot of people have seen sense in it and have felt a little bit more confident that there is more to this idea of, you know, the greatest plan, the best, you know, the peace plan of the century. There is more to it than was previously felt, you know, where, as I say, there was a lot of cynicism around the fact that there might not even be a plan to speak of at all. But now there does seem to be something, and a lot of people are really buying into the approach and some of the sensible ideas that have been raised in it, even though, as we know, of course, the Palestinians have kept themselves out of it. And I think that really the focus for now is going to be for somehow the U.S. administration to find a way for the Palestinians to climb down the tree and to come back to the party in order for them to be part of, you know, what's being promoted here.
Absolutely amazing. And it'll be interesting to see what the political solution is, because I think that's obviously vital. 50% of Tel Aviv traffic is now on scooters and bicycles. That's incredible. But how is Tel Aviv coping with this from a traffic perspective?
Well, first of all, this little statistic, which kind of, you know, went over the heads of a lot of people, I think is amazing.
It is.
That 50% of the city's traffic is on bicycles and scooters. Can you understand that? What the significance of that is?
Yeah.
Apparently, it puts Tel Aviv on a par with cities like Copenhagen and Amsterdam. Now, I've never visited Copenhagen, but I've certainly been in Amsterdam a few times, and I counted myself lucky not to be run over by a bicycle.
Yeah.
And actually, I visited the central station in Amsterdam where they've got that bicycle parking area, and I just wondered how anybody ever found their bicycle there again. I mean,
it's the same in Copenhagen. It's exactly
bicycles.
Right.
It was just the most, maddest thing I've ever seen in my life. But be that as it may, the Dutch are very much bicycle people, and I've seen them riding around in the middle of the winter in -5 degrees and wrapped up and, you know, sliding on ice and all the rest of it, but they're still on their bicycles. It doesn't matter. And so apparently Tel Aviv is in that particular category, that particular bracket, where so many people are now using not only shared transportation, but also electric transportation, because of course most of the scooters and the bicycles that we're talking about are electric vehicles. And this was a statistic that was revealed by the Lime CEO, Brad Bayo, who's been in Tel Aviv. Lime is one of the four companies that is operating electric scooters, that are operating electric scooters in Tel Aviv. And they were, I think, the second ones in the market. Mm-hmm. And would you believe that just Lime by themselves have 2,000 electric scooters in the Tel Aviv and Ramat Gan area that obviously are being rented out and recharged all the time and people are using. And that's just one of four companies.
Amazing.
So, you know, one could imagine if you multiply that by four, that we're going to get, you know, somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 scooters probably spread, you know, distributed around Tel Aviv and Ramat Gan, which I think is amazing. For those people who have seen how this works, it creates a huge impression. On the one hand, it's a great way of being out and open and sharing things, because everybody's out on their bicycles, on their scooters. People are very approachable. There is a certain camaraderie about, you know, this style of transport. On the other hand, it has become a bit of a nuisance, because there are scooters and bicycles sprayed on the pavements everywhere. It's become a little bit of an issue that the Tel Aviv municipality is trying to deal with. But overall, I think since Tel Aviv has become so congested, while the light rail system is being built and there are so many roadworks and so many disruptions to the traffic, roads closed everywhere, you know, renovation and excavation work going on all around the city, that having these bicycles and these scooters has really been exactly what the city needs in order to cope with this, because, you know, car transport is virtually impossible. So there you go. 50% of the city's traffic apparently on bikes and scooters. I'm amazed by that.
How would you say?
No, I wanted to, and maybe after the news we can come back and just talk about how Lime and its competitors work, because it's not something we have in South Africa, and I think the business model is
fantastic. All right, so we'll take that from there. Anthony Reich, thank you as always. Fascinating conversation, and we'll catch you same time, same place tomorrow. It is 8 o'clock.